Next up, Omo Clayton Mortgage shares his thoughts on things to know about organizing.
Today, I'd like to step back from the issues of the moment and ask the very big question, what kind of political movement could make a real difference in the way our world is governed? The human community and the biosphere are governed, controlled, and exploited by a tiny but enormously wealthy elite who have no goals other than to maintain their power and increase their profits. Neoliberalism is the ideology that rationalizes this plutocracy, the doctrine that the rights of private property should take precedence over concerns for any larger community, that government should be minimal and neither tax nor regulate the enterprises of individuals and corporations. Individuals should succeed or fail in the competitive world without public support. Neoliberals, however, do want a government with a big security apparatus to put down any resistance that might arise against the elites, as we just heard from Christian Williams and Bill Resnick. Over the last several years, it has become obvious that this way of running the world is leaving millions in poverty and insecurity, while the wealthy few get wealthier by the minute, and the earth slouches on towards environmental collapse. Even if the economy should improve and put more people back to work, the underlying insecurity remains, and more greenhouse gases are pumped into the sky. What kind of a political movement could be equal to the radical task of changing the direction in which we are headed? Sam Gindin has some suggestions in an article called Unmaking Global Capitalism, Nine Things to Know About Organizing in the Belly of the Beast, published in the current issue of Jacobin magazine. I'm going to discuss just two of these things. First, austerity and bad news do not make people question the status quo. Speaking of the waves of cuts associated with Reagan and Thatcher, but that began even earlier, he writes, "The frustrations of austerity did not generally lead to radicalization, but only increased pressures on working-class families to maintain as much consumption as they could. Without collective solutions, they found other ways to support themselves, thereby undermining the development of the working class as an oppositional class. Family members extended their hours of work, students also became full-time workers, and young couples moved in with their families. The ironic outcome of these forms of survival was that they contributed to reproducing the very neoliberal sense of individualism that has so damaged working-class lives. As people were forced by austerity to rely only on themselves, they increasingly thought of themselves as independent and self-sufficient, and that everyone else ought to be as well. So, picket lines and street protests faded in relevance, and cultures of solidarity and collective capacities to struggle atrophied. This further divided workers. Workers doing relatively well resented paying taxes on their hard-earned income to support those on welfare, while welfare recipients and the unemployed were bitter about unions who ignored their plight. The lesson, then, is that crisis-mongering as a mechanism for overcoming political apathy is to be avoided. Gindin writes, "Continuously declaring that a decisive crisis is around the corner may generate attention, but it may just as well scare people and bring out their most conservative instincts. It may lower expectations and make people long for the way things used to be, desperately hoping to fix, not transform, or even significantly modify capitalism. We cannot depend on crises to do our political work for us. If we think that capitalism is a system that blocks human progress, then the challenge is to convince people that capitalism is the problem even when it is working at its best. A related tendency is that of environmental catastrophism. To be sure, the climate crisis must be decisively confronted. But declarations that the end of the planet is only decades away, if capitalism isn't radically changed now, may just reinforce a sense that we are doomed and can't really do anything about it. A better way to address the environmental crisis would be to frame the issue of the environment around a broader struggle that includes the redistribution of income and wealth to more equitably share the costs of environmental restraint, and a cultural shift in the balance between individual consumption of goods and collective services. Now, the second thing Sam Gindin wants us to know about organizing in the belly of the beast is that our politics must ultimately reckon with state power if we are to confront power where it is most concentrated. It's no good just protesting capitalism. It must be replaced. And that requires, quoting again, transforming state institutions in the deepest democratic sense, imagining and struggling for a state whose main function at national, regional, and municipal levels would no longer be to defend and advance the interests of capital, but would be to support and develop our collective capacities to democratize the economy and all aspects of our lives. Now, this goal demands a politics that goes beyond the horizontal and spontaneous forms of organizing that characterized the Occupy movement. Quoting again, "The glorification within these movements of spontaneity and fragmentation comes close to mirroring neoliberalism's own drive to freer markets, individualism, and a workforce that has no stability or roots. There seems to be a notion that radical change will evolve out of the accumulation of protests, and so little attention is paid to developing a deeper analysis of events. Occupy's refusal to put forth a program was at first a stroke of tactical genius, because it implied that the problem was not a specific issue, but the system as a whole. But in terms of longer-term movement building, this refusal soon became a severe liability. This style of mobilization can bring people out, but it cannot organize them into a movement that builds and sustains an ever-expanding collective power. Absent such structures, democracy is reduced to forms of dialogue, not shared agreements. A purely horizontal politics blocks decisive collective action, and we wind up with permanent protest instead of a politics of transformative change." Identity politics emerged in the 1970s, in part out of the failures of the left to speak to and integrate specific oppressions into class politics, those of women and African Americans in particular. But while identity politics often added to and strengthened working class politics, it also included a dangerous tendency to push the salience of class aside. It was bitterly ironic that at the very moment the state mounted a comprehensive attack on working class power, identity politics was parsing the working class into ever more fragmented subgroups. Though identities obviously matter a great deal, they cannot combine into a new politics because their essence is their separateness. Something else is needed to bring them together in a broader, more integrated, and more coherent politics, something beyond the particularistic concerns of both identities and unions. That something is class." End of quote. So, the project of the left in educating and organizing must be learning to perceive, feel, think, and act around the fact that we are all subjected to capital, and only a movement that organizes on that basis has any chance of replacing capitalism with a world that works for all of us. I've been talking about and reading from Sam Gindin's piece, Unmaking Global Capitalism, from the current issue of Jacobin magazine. We'll post a link to the whole, much longer article when today's Old Mole is posted online. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.